In the long history of American demagogues, from Huey Long to, yes, Donald Trump, never has one man caused so much damage in such a short time as Senator Joseph McCarthy. We still use McCarthyism to stand for outrageous charges of guilt by association, a weapon of polarizing slander. From 1950 to 1954, McCarthy destroyed many careers and even entire lives, whipping the nation into a frenzy of paranoia, accusation, loyalty oaths, and terror. When the public finally turned on him, he came crashing down, dying of alcoholism in 1957. Larry Tye's new biography, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy, is a portrait of a human being capable of immense evil, yet beguiling charm. McCarthy was a tireless worker and a genuine war hero. When he made it to the Senate, he flailed around in search of an agenda. Finally, after 3 years, he hit upon anti-communism. Larry Tye is the best-selling author of Bobby Kennedy and Satchel, as well as Superman, the father of Spin, Homelands, and Rising from the Rails. He's a frequent guest on our program, which I'm very, very happy about. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Larry Tye back to the roundtable. How are you, Larry?
I'm well. Great to be back with you, Joe.
Great to have you on the program. Thank you very much. I think the last time we had you on was for Superman. So it does wonder of, in my mind, of you finish Superman and say, oh, you know, Joe McCarthy would be a cool person.
So this is the penance that I have to do for getting to write about a guy like Superman.
Yeah, right?
So actually, a day before the election in 2016, I had signed up to write a biography of Barack Obama. And the day after the election, I realized not only wouldn't we know Barack Obama's legacy until the end of the era of Trump, but that suddenly a story like Joe McCarthy's, that had looked like a story of ancient history, was a story of today.
So in taking on Joe McCarthy, and I was fascinated in this book because I learned so much. As I said in the introduction, we use this McCarthyism, and we certainly often look and will bring up McCarthy's name. But, man, there was a lot I didn't know about the guy and how he was able to do what he did. And you know, so you say over a relatively short time of 4 years, but during that 4 years, that seemed like an eternity. Right? I mean, it was a lot
so
of...
So it did seem like an eternity, and we can relate these days, depending on your politics, that
right.
4 years can seem like a very long time. And in those 4 years, he rose to be the second most popular person in America, trailing only the wartime war hero President Dwight Eisenhower. Fully one in every two Americans said that Joe McCarthy was doing a great job. And it was only when America really got to see him up close on their TV screens during the famous Army-McCarthy hearings that people started to realize that instead of a heroic character, this guy looked more like a town bully.
Mm.
And he went from 50% popularity at the start of those hearings in 1954 to the end of them that summer. He had plummeted to 34%, and he was all but done.
So before we go on and talk about McCarthy himself, I'm interested in you telling us about some of the material that you use for this book. You got first access to some of his personal and professional papers and even some of his medical and military records. There were unsealed transcripts of closed-door congressional hearings you got to see. So with that information, what were you allowed to do with that then?
So what I did with that was tried to present a more nuanced portrait of who this guy was. And in some ways, he was better than we had known. People had thought that he was lying all those years about being a wartime hero during World War II. And he had called himself Tail Gunner Joe, and people made fun of that, saying, oh, no, he wasn't a tail gunner. He was a land-based intelligence agent. And it was all another of his lies and embellishment. Well, we can see from his real-time handwritten diaries during World War II from the field that, in fact, he did volunteer for one mission after another. And there was His comrades in arms wrote letters saying he flew with us and he flew under enemy fire and he didn't have to be doing this. So in a case like that, we have Joe McCarthy suddenly looking like a truth teller. And the lesson, I think, there is that if you lie often enough, when you're telling the truth, nobody will believe you.
Right.
But in other cases, we look at what he did when the doors shut on the hearing rooms and when he threw out the journalists and the public. And at that point, he stopped even pretending to care about the rights of those who were being accused. He held one-man hearings, which was a violation of long-standing Senate tradition. And when he wasn't there grilling witnesses, he had these sophomoric staffers leap in to badger witnesses on his behalf. And this was Joe McCarthy, when he thought nobody was looking, at his unvarnished, snarling essence.
So, in other words, these claims about the redemption that comes in his claims about about the war have little to do with redeeming him more broadly in his claims about communism and the rest of his behavior.
Now, he was worse than we thought, which is going a long way, because he was probably American school children don't have any worse villain that they ever learn about than low-blow Joe McCarthy. And when we look at his personal and professional papers and all the other hidden records, we see that the low blows were even more devastating than we thought.
Why did he switch political parties? And not only parties, but a complete overhaul in political ideology?
So it's a great question, and the answer is for the same reason he did just about everything in his life, which was to win. He was an opportunist. He ran for district attorney in rural Wisconsin as a flaming New Deal FDR Democrat and liberal, and when he realized after he lost badly that he would never win office as a liberal Democrat, probably one night in the middle of the night, he went in and changed his party registration, and he ended up not just being a Republican, but representing the most conservative wing of the Wisconsin Republican Party, which was pretty right-wing. And there, as everywhere, he did whatever it took. And if I can tell you one quick story that to me, captures his opportunism better than anything. And it was in February of 1950, when he delivered the most famous speech of his life, in Wheeling, West Virginia. He showed up at a Lincoln Day dinner honoring the standard bearer of the Republican Party, Abe Lincoln's birthday. And he had in his briefcase two speeches. One was a snoozer on national housing policy, which turned out to be something he actually knew something about. Had he delivered that speech 70 years later, you and I wouldn't be here talking about Joe McCarthy, because he would have gone on to lose re-election and nobody would have ever paid attention to him. Instead, he pulled out of his briefcase a barn burner of a speech that he waved around in the air, saying that he had in his hand a list of 205 spies, Soviet spies, at the U.S. State Department. And he realized something that earlier red-baiting senators hadn't, that if you didn't just say there was traitorous activity, but if you named and counted the traitors, people would pay attention. It was a cowboy-like mentality. He, in fact, never had the list that he said in his hand. He never showed anybody the list that he did have, and he could never prove any of the charges he brought. But that didn't matter. He got the limelight. And for 4.5 years, he never gave it up.
Yeah, it seems like he comes up with a number and then comes up with as many names as to achieve that, right? I mean, it was putting the cart before the horse in that sense.
He did. So there was one theory that one of his numbers was 57. And the theory was that this guy who loved hamburgers had stopped at a restaurant, poured Heinz 57 sauce on his hamburger, and remembered that number. And that was his number at his next speech.
Good as any reason. One of the things that really gets to the heart of it, though, is America takes to the idea. And he becomes the champion on behalf of the country. This wouldn't have worked if people were not interested, concerned, and outraged as he seemed to be. How surprised was he about that in choosing that particular speech at that particular time of how Americans would react to it?
So I think he was shocked. The idea that his speech made the front page of every newspaper in America, and the idea that people actually believed his hokum, I think was shocking to him. And I think it is an indictment of his fellow senators who never stood up to him. It is an indictment of his enabler-in-chief, President Eisenhower, who took 2 years to finally do some things to bring him down. And most of all, is an indictment of us. We bought his stuff, what fellow senators had labeled rightly a fraud and a hoax. And I think it suggests our naivete then and with all the demagogues who came before him and those who continue to this day. And by the way, demagogue is one word. A simpler word for the same thing is bully, and that's what it's really all about.
Demagogue is the name of the new book. The Wife and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry Tye is our guest, a best-selling author, also an award-winning reporter and national writer at the Boston Globe. I throw that in because I'm interested in, there's a great deal in the book about the media. And tell us a little bit about what his relationship was with the press. In Washington, around the country, in Wisconsin, and ultimately, who became the media heroes in the story?
So the media too quickly bought into everything that he was selling. Reporters knew it would put them on the front page to charge. There were spies in the State Department. He knew enough when he was raising his initial charges not to do it in Washington, where reporters could pick up the phone and call the State Department for a response, but to do it in an outlying place like Wheeling, West Virginia, where he delivered his first speech, and to do it 5 minutes before deadline, so there was no chance to get a response in that next day's page one story. He manipulated the press, he charmed the press, and then later on, when the news got bad, he blamed the newsmen. And he set the playbook for people who would come after and who would take on the media. The heroes in this story, if you were to believe Hollywood, the hero was a guy named Edward R. Murrow, who was the hero in a very famous movie called Good Night and Good Luck.
Right.
But in fact, Murrow was late to the fight. The real hero was a guy named Drew Pearson, the most popular columnist and radio commentator in the country at the time, who, when he went up against McCarthy, in one occasion, McCarthy physically accosted him at a nightclub, and if it hadn't been for a famous Quaker named Richard Nixon stepping between the two of them, McCarthy would have pummeled Pearson. McCarthy also went after Pearson's radio sponsors. He got the biggest sponsor to withdraw that sponsorship, and he wanted to show by bulldozing Drew Pearson, warn any reporter that you came after Joe McCarthy at your own peril.
You talk about the transcripts from the closed door hearings and the personal and professional papers that were locked up for more than half a century at Marquette University. And you touched on this earlier, but that unvarnished Joe McCarthy in those closed hearings, what sense do you get? Because this is really when the world isn't looking, right? So what do we learn from him in those moments of, I guess, of the continuous of the rise, but also really the Achilles heel, if you will, as well, right?
Yes. So two things that I think were interesting that we learned from those hearings. One is that he was using the badgering of witnesses behind closed doors to see who could stand up to him and who couldn't. And the ones who couldn't ended up in public hearings. The ones he could intimidate, the ones he couldn't intimidate never showed up in the public because he would look bad and he didn't want to look bad. But what we also learn is that every day when he would go into the hearings, in the morning he would be pretty rational and he would be relatively understanding of witnesses. Then he would go to lunch and have a hamburger, a raw onion, and whiskey. And he'd come back in the afternoon, and he'd quickly lose his patience. And I think, and we can see from his medical records, the amount of alcohol that he was consuming, and I think he was losing his patience mainly because he was only partly sober in the afternoon. And also, and I feel badly for him, we learned from his medical records that he had hemorrhoids. And if you're sitting on hemorrhoids for an entire day and into the night, he was hurting, he had lost some of his sobriety, and it showed in the way he treated witnesses.
Ever the journalist, you do paint a picture, Larry. So let me ask you about the, you know, the downfall, and because that really came as quick as Wheeling, West Virginia. It came quick, and it I mean, in the sense of when it started, it was really a ball of fire.
It was. So the downfall came for a couple reasons. One is because he took on an enemy that was too big to bully. It was one thing bullying the State Department or bullying the Voice of America. Americans generally couldn't relate to either institution. But when he took on the U.S. Army, that was going too far. The military brass eventually developed a backbone. President Eisenhower stood up for his soldiers, and that proved to be Joe McCarthy's undoing. It also was his undoing, as we talked earlier, just when the public could see him day after day on television and see that this guy with a 5 o'clock shadow, with a finger pointing and a scowl perpetually there, it looked like he was the bully that he was. The hearings saw his popularity plummet. The Senate, watching his numbers go down, suddenly developed the courage to take on their colleague. By the end of 1954, his colleagues had condemned him. He was politically dead. And from then until the end of his life in 1957, he was a walking corpse, never making the newspapers, never on the front page, and never getting the attention that was his lifeblood.
We only have about a minute and a half left, but I'm interested in what you make of, you know, the book coming, as you say, coming. I mean, you wrote this right after the 2016 election. Here we are going into the 2020 election. Donald Trump has been our president for nearly 4 years. So what does that tell us about really the legacy of McCarthy, of McCarthyism, and the rise of Donald Trump?
It tells us that fans of Joe McCarthy had to wait nearly 70 years, but that they now have in the White House somebody who seems on a daily basis to be using Joe McCarthy's playbook. At times when I was researching this book, it was confusing to me. Was I reading 70-year-old documents, or was I reading that day's newspaper? Because the tactics seem so similar. And it turns out that Joe McCarthy's protege, Roy Cohn, was Donald Trump's tutor. So there was a flesh and blood through line between the two.
You know, this book is 600 pages, and I got to the end of it, and I wish there was another 500 or 600 pages left. You write with such a beauty and clarity, and it's just an amazing piece of work. The new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Larry Tye, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Great being on again.
Thank you very much. Again, Larry Tye's new book is Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.